From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark reports from Iraq. He says U.S. aircraft bombed Iraq this weekend, killing 8 people. We'll also speak with the lieutenant in charge of Operation Southern Watch. Over 100 immigrant airport workers have been detained at Southern California airports. We'll look at the federal law that says immigrants who do not have green cards will not be able to work at airports after November. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracies die behind closed doors, so says a federal appeals court in Cincinnati. It unanimously ruled on Monday the Bush administration broke the law by holding hundreds of deportation hearings in secret, based only on the claim they may have links to terrorism. The court found that deportation proceedings must be public unless the government can prove on a case-by-case basis that a secret hearing is needed. It's the first major appellate-level ruling on the Justice Department's legal tactics in the so-called War on Terror. Judge Damon Keith wrote, "When government begins closing doors, it selectively controls information rightfully belonging to the people. Selective information is misinformation." The case was brought by 4 Michigan newspapers and Democratic Congressmember John Conyers. They sought to attend deportation hearings of Rabi Haddad, a prominent Muslim community leader in Ann Arbor, who had overstayed his tourist visa. Trial court judges in Newark and Washington have also recently ordered the government to open hearings and release information about people who have been held in connection with terrorism investigations, but those rulings have yet to be tested on appeal. Vice President Dick Cheney has presented the Bush administration's arguments for attacking Iraq. He told a Nashville convention of the veterans of foreign wars that there is, quote, no doubt Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and is preparing to use them against the U.S. and its allies. He said Iraq will soon have nuclear weapons, presenting no proof. He said, quote, armed with an arsenal of these weapons of terror and 10% of the world's oil reserves, Saddam Hussein could then be expected to seek domination of the entire Middle East. Cheney went on to say, take control of a great portion of the world's energy supplies, directly threaten America's friends throughout the region, and subject the United States or any other nation to nuclear blackmail. Cheney added, the risks of inaction are far greater than the risk of action. But Syria's chief of staff said Washington's goal of toppling the Iraqi government is actually an attempt to rearrange the regional balance of power to match U.S. and Israeli interests under cover of the claim that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Hassan Turkmani's first public comments were released before Cheney's speech. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is notifying more than 14,000 reservists they may be required to serve 2 years instead of one. The extension would be the first since the Vietnam War. A leaked document prepared for the world's richest countries and seen by the London Guardian reports the real level of world inequality and environmental degradation is far worse than official estimates. Among the document's findings, 3 million people die each year due to air pollution and 5 million due to unsafe water. The world has lost almost 10% of its forests in the past 10 years, and 15% of forest species will be extinct by 2025. Carbon dioxide emissions leading to global warming are expected to rise by a third in rich countries and 100% in the rest of the world in the next 20 years. The world's richest countries subsidize the emission of global warming gases by nearly $60 billion, exactly what the report estimates it would cost to meet international targets. Less than 0.1% of the average income of the 22 richest countries actually finds its way to the world's low-income countries. Donor assistance for environmental protection and basic social services has declined by almost 25% since the last Earth Summit 10 years ago. The document was based on many previously unseen UN, World Bank, World Trade Organization, and academic reports. The Los Angeles Times is reporting FBI agents are working undercover with local Pakistani security forces who have a long history of human rights abuses. The joint effort is cloaked in secrecy. Some Pakistani officials say privately the number of FBI counterterrorism specialists in Pakistan is in the low hundreds. There is mounting suspicion in Pakistan that FBI or CIA agents are involved in the pursuit and arrest of people who have since disappeared. In interviews, relatives of terror suspects have described groups, foreigners participating in Pakistani police raids, usually as silent observers who closely monitor searches. Spanish police today defused a bomb placed outside a court in the northern Basque city of Tolosa, just hours after Spain's high court outlawed the Basque separatist party, Batasuna. Spain's most senior anti-terrorism judge, Baltasar Garzon, ordered that the 24-year-old party's offices be closed and its activities suspended for 3 years. Police stormed the party's head office in Pamplona late last night and closed it down. Batasuna's failure to denounce a car bombing earlier this month that killed two people, including a 6-year-old girl, catalyzed the legal proceedings. More moderate Basque parties say the ban will be counterproductive, allowing Batasuna supporters to claim they have no democratic voice and that there is no alternative to armed struggle for independence. The newly appointed Israeli chief of staff, Lieutenant General Moshe Yaalon, is urging a decisive victory to destroy the, quote, cancer-like threat posed by the Palestinians. General Yaalon had been under the impression he was making a private speech on Sunday to a conference of rabbis in Jerusalem. Journalists had been barred. But the Israeli daily Yediot Aharonot obtained a tape of the speech and published it. Back in the United States, President Bush's lawyers are trying to keep secret the inside stories of President Clinton's last day pardons by invoking a claim of executive privilege that extends far beyond the White House. In pleadings filed in U.S. District Court, the Bush administration contends the privilege covers not only advice given to a president about individual pardons, but also government papers he's never seen and officials he's never talked to, such as the sentencing judge in a particular case. The stance taken in opposition to a lawsuit filed by the nonprofit group Judicial Watch for access to Clinton pardon records represents a hard line that the government has never taken. In the past, executive privilege has been recognized for advisors who operate within the White House. Bush's lawyers say it covers officials in any part of the government who are asked for input about pardon requests. A Detroit man who confessed to the rape and murder of a 16-year-old girl in 1984 was set free yesterday as DNA evidence proved his innocence. Eddie Joe Lloyd was convicted in 1985 based on a taped confession he made to Detroit police while he was in a mental hospital, despite the lack of any physical evidence. Lloyd said the officer who interviewed him indicated his confession would help flush out the real killer. He said he had no idea he would spend the next 17 years in prison. Lloyd's lawyers are calling on the Justice Department to investigate. They say the case highlights a national problem of false confessions, particularly with suspects who are minors or who suffer from mental illness. Lloyd is the 110th convicted person in the United States and the first in Michigan to be exonerated by DNA testing. And the town of Springfield, Florida, will soon be graced with police cars covered with corporate sponsorship logos similar to those on race cars. In return, the town will pay only $1 for each new police car.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. With the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio talk shows and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA
dance for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
Lives in the Balance. Jackson Browne here on Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. The Iraqi military says a U.S.-British air raid in southern Iraq on Sunday left 8 civilians dead, 9 wounded. The U.S. Central Command in Florida said coalition aircraft used precision-guided weapons to strike 2 air defense radar systems near the Basra province south of Baghdad, quote, in response to recent Iraqi hostile acts against coalition aircraft monitoring the southern no-fly zone. Iraq said U.S. and British warplanes attacked civilian targets in the south of the country Monday for the second consecutive day. A civilian was injured. U.S. officials have said they have no way of confirming or denying Iraqi claims of casualties. We turn now to Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General under Lyndon Johnson. He speaks to us from Basra. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's good to hear your voice.
Can you describe where you are and what you have found?
Well, I'm sitting right near the edge of the Shatt al-Arab, which is a famous water course after the Tigris and Euphrates join and flow into the Arabian Gulf. We've been doing interviews at hospitals. We're right by the training hospital, the Basra training hospital. And the misery from the sanctions and all here is as great as ever. Naturally, there's also a lot of concern about the possibility of a major offensive against the people who've endured a lot. They had 88,500 tons of bombs dropped on them in 1991, and they've been attacked probably every week since March of 1991 for the heavy bombing. They had this recent attack here. It's really one of hundreds, but it's tragic because they think now the death toll is 9. The chief physician at the Basra training hospital told us just a few minutes ago that he thought several more would probably die. There were a lot of casualties. This hospital happens to be fairly distant from the site of the bombing, but there was one man who was not conscious here that we saw. He had a wound to the right arm and the lower right abdomen and to the head, but they thought he'd be all right. We've been killing people like that fairly regularly. We've never lost a plane. We've never had a casualty. We've never even scared anybody. None of our people have ever been scared. That is, we've scared
Ramsey Clark
here continuously.
Ramsey Clark, we're also joined by Lieutenant David LaPan, who is with Operation Southern Watch, the Pentagon division in charge of the U.S. military that flies over Iraq and bombs the northern and southern areas. Can you talk about what happened this weekend, Lieutenant LaPan?
Sure, Amy. Well, actually, let me clarify a couple things. My proper rank is Lieutenant Colonel. I work for the Department of Defense in Washington, not directly for Operation Southern Watch, which is based there in the region.
But I just want to clarify to Ramsey Clark that we are talking to Lieutenant Colonel David LaPan to get confirmation from the military about what happened this weekend. Go ahead.
What they say happened.
Sure. As we discussed briefly yesterday, coalition aircraft responded on Sunday to aircraft or anti-aircraft artillery fire directed at them from Iraqi military sites. They responded on Sunday, dropping precision-guided munitions on those sites. As we've said, we have no way of confirming or denying whether there were any casualties, specifically whether those casualties may have been military or civilian. We certainly go to great lengths to avoid any type of civilian casualties. Our quarrel is not with the Iraqi people at all. It's with the Iraqi military. And if the Iraqi military would not threaten our aircraft and would not shoot at our aircraft, these responses would not continue. The only reason we take action is in response to these threats. And with all due respect to Mr. Clark, I would take exception to his comments that our crews are never scared or threatened. They certainly are on a daily basis fired upon, illuminated with fire control radar, and other hostile actions taken by the Iraqi forces.
Ramsey Clark?
12 years, none of them being hit. I'd write an insurance policy for them if they need one. I don't mean to say that just getting in the jet isn't dangerous, but it's really about as dangerous as flying over South Florida or anyplace else. To kill civilians like that, and you're in what you call a no-fly zone, but that's not authorized by the United Nations. That's a sovereign territory of Iraq. You have no right to be flying over here. But God knows you don't have right, week after week, to be killing civilians and soldiers, whoever they are, on Iraqi soil because you think they fired at you but never hit you.
Well, again, it's not a question of thinking that they fired upon us. It's that they have actually fired on our aircraft on numerous occasions. Again, it happens on a daily basis over Iraq. And if the Iraqis would not fire at our aircraft, we would not respond. So the person at the foot of this problem is Saddam Hussein. If he were to comply with the UN resolutions, if he were to comply with the agreements that he made at the end of the Gulf War, we wouldn't be there.
Flying over their territory. You have never been hit in 12 years. You say they're shooting at you every day, which means you're flying over their territory every day. What right do you have to keep shooting at civilians who can't, killing civilians on the ground a whole bunch this last weekend when they haven't hurt you at all? You can fly safely. You've proven you can fly safely. They haven't hit you in all these years. If you're going to violate their rights and violate international law and fly over their airspace, at least don't kill their people while you do it.
Well, again, I would point out that we do not.
You don't care about these dead people, apparently. These people are Iraqis. You didn't hit Saddam Hussein. You hit Iraqi people. They hadn't hurt anybody. They hadn't done anything. You've done it time and time again, and you know it.
What are the estimates, Lieutenant Colonel David LaPan, that you have of the number of Iraqis the U.S. military has killed in these bombings over the last 10 years?
Well, we don't have any estimates because we have no way of confirming what has happened on the ground there. We can certainly tell from intelligence sources whether military equipment may have been destroyed or disabled. But we certainly don't have the ability to tell if anyone has been injured or killed, and further to be able to tell if those were military people or civilians.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned that civilians are being killed?
We're always concerned, but again, we take extraordinary measures to ensure that our strikes are directed at military targets. We use precision-guided weapons who we admit are not 100% accurate. But the fact that we use them and no other countries do show that we do have concern for hitting exactly what we're going after and not inflicting damage outside of that.
Ramsey Clark,
we pick those targets specifically to disable the Iraqi air defense system so they can't threaten our aircraft, and we do so with an eye toward civilian populations. Unfortunately, Saddam Hussein and his forces
many times choose to put military equipment and military facilities in the center of civilian populations because they obviously don't care for the civilian population, as they've shown over the years.
Ramsey Clark, what estimates do you have of the number of Iraqis who have been killed by these bombings?
If you want to, but the fact is you're just shooting regularly, and you've admitted that you're choosing your targets. And if you're choosing your targets, then you're not returning fire, and you don't have any more right to kill an Iraqi soldier than you have to kill an Iraqi woman nursing her baby. You're not at war. There's no declaration of war. You're in their airspace illegally, and you shouldn't be shooting, and you know it. And if we keep doing that, we're not going to have a friend on earth and don't deserve any. We're going to have this whole region angry at the United States. You just can't go around killing people like that and claim it's because some guy named Saddam Hussein is bad.
Ramsey Clark, what estimates do you have of the number of people who have been killed by U.S. bombs over the last 10 years?
Well, Amy, we're talking about a very minor fraction of those who've been killed by the sanctions. I can tell you on one day, for instance, it was January the 19th, 1993, that we launched about 20 Tomahawk cruise missiles. We hit the Al Rashid Hotel. We killed Ali Al-Attar, who's one of the great artists, great women painters in the Arab world, internationally known. We destroyed her home and her children and her life, not her art, thank heavens. We probably killed two people sweeping up in the lobby of the Al Rashid. And we know why that missile was fired. There was a meeting that this bad man that our friend from the Air Force, or Army, whatever he is, has been talking about, is going to have a meeting there of Muslim leaders. And they thought they might, on the last day of a former presidency, get to kill, assassinate, if you will, a foreign leader, meeting with Islamic leaders from the whole region. I think on that single day, probably 25 or 30 people were killed, as I recall. I can remember in the Mosul area, times when four, five, six people were killed. It'd be over 10 years. He's talking about every day. I don't think it's every day, but it's probably close to every day. He should know better than I do. Mm-hmm. The Air Force should know how many flights it has and how many times they're shooting. It could be way, way up in the hundreds, maybe in the thousands. I don't know. Not as many as they killed when they dropped 88,500 tons of bombs on Iraq and 110,000 aerial sorties in 42 days, one every 30 seconds.
Lieutenant Colonel David LePan, what would the U.S. do if Iraq flew planes over the United States?
They wouldn't get over the United States before they were shot down.
No, I'm asking Lieutenant Colonel David LePan, what would the U.S. do if Saddam Hussein flew planes over the United States?
Well, one, I don't think it's a fair comparison. The no-fly zones were imposed after the Gulf War. Contrary to what Mr. Clark has said, if the U.N.
The United Nations did not authorize these no-fly zones, Colonel, and you know it.
Now, the United Nations authorized member states to take whatever actions were necessary to stop the genocide that was going on in the north and in the south.
No, they didn't say
genocide.
No-fly
zones were imposed to keep the Iraqi government from attacking civilian populations in the north and in the south and from advancing on their neighbors like they did in Kuwait.
The UN, I'd like for you to come over here and explain that to the families of these nine people who died from Sunday's bombing. I'm sure they'd appreciate that. There's some genocide going on here, and that's why you justified unilateral U.S. action without the approval of the United Nations?
Again, the no-fly zones are based in U.N. Security Council resolutions. I mean, they're completely legal.
No, there's not a member of the Security Council that believes that, including our ambassador. We've been criticized uniformly, internationally, for the no-fly zones as being not authorized by the United Nations, and you must know that. Everybody knows that.
Again, I would just say that if the Iraqis would refrain from firing at our aircraft, they would be attacked in response. And as far as the Iraqis flying aircraft to the United States, again, the United States did not agree at the end of the Gulf War to comply to UN Security Council resolutions, which we have failed to do, which they have failed to do. So it's comparing apples and oranges.
Well, another question.
It's just been 365 days. That'd be in 10 years, that'd be 3,650 days in which you fired on Iraqi people because you claim somebody shot at you, but they never hit you. It's getting pretty monotonous to kill people all that time when nothing ever happens to you, isn't it?
Well, that's absolutely false, Mr. Clark. There, we fly most every day, not every single day.
You're the one who
said
every day.
And we certainly do not fire every single day. What I said originally was that the Iraqis fire at our aircraft on a daily basis. We do not respond to them every time they shoot at us.
You were shot at 600. All I said was you were shot at 3,650 times. If it was one time a day over 10 years, and they never hit you. That's all I said. I didn't say you hit them every day.
Well, not being hit is a measure of success. I would not be responsible as an American service member to agree that if we had aircraft shot down, that would be a good thing.
We have to break.
I'd walk down the street every day for 10 years, and somebody shot at me every day, and I shot back. I'd get tired of killing people simply because they seemed to shoot at me but could never hit me. I don't think you can possibly justify that morally or legally.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We are speaking with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He's in Basra, has just visited the site in Iraq where over the weekend he says that he has seen evidence that the U.S. Struck, U.S. bombs were dropped, and that 8 people were killed, others were injured. We're speaking in the U.S. with Lieutenant Colonel David LePan with the Pentagon. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in a minute.
How dark is the smoke that falls from the sky?
Killed on that night, more than they could count when they threw them in trucks. Some children were kneeling, the saints were all calm. Chitters and gunshots reveal all the blood. Oh, great cave of smoke, oh, children of stones. What beautiful birth, so short is your road.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. On the line with us is Lieutenant Colonel David LePan of the Pentagon and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark in Iraq. Over the weekend, U.S. and British warplanes attacked Iraq. 8 civilians, Ramsey Clark reports, have been killed with others wounded. I have a question for Lieutenant Colonel David LePan on this issue of those who get killed with the U.S. Bombs. You talked about U.S. intelligence letting you know whether you have crippled Iraqi military. What kind of satellite imagery do you have? What kind of intelligence on the ground to let you know if people are killed or wounded?
Well, again, as I mentioned, we don't have the ability to confirm to that level of detail whether individuals were killed or wounded. Our technology, which I can't speak to in particular, will give us an idea of whether a target has been hit. So we can see buildings, we can see pieces of equipment, things of that nature. It doesn't allow us to be able to tell if individuals have been taken to a hospital somewhere for treatment, whether there, you know, were a number of individuals and who they were, whether they were military or civilian. We just don't have that ability.
But are you able to see bodies on the ground? I know with Iconos satellite imagery that the Pentagon bought up the exclusive rights to in Afghanistan, you can see bodies on the ground.
Well, again, that presumes that we have the ability in real time to look at what is going on the ground. I would think that, as in most cases where there's an incident where people are injured, they're immediately or fairly immediately taken away for treatment. So it's not a question of being able to look, you know, a time in the future to tell what happened there.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
But let me they take away the dead and injured as quickly as they can, Colonel. You're right about that. Let me ask you whether you're using depleted uranium ammunition when you shoot at Iraq now. We just watched a bunch of people dying from radiation from depleted uranium here in the southern part of Iraq.
Well, I can tell you that currently we do not use any depleted uranium. There may be people who were injured during the Gulf War, again, that when Iraq invaded Kuwait, in which depleted uranium was used in some cases against Iraqi military targets, but it is not used today.
Well, these people weren't military targets. You can tell by looking at them. They're women, and still some 10 years later, some of them are quite young. But they do have leukemia, and they do have tumors, and they do have cancers, and they do have deformed babies, and they do have miscarriages of deformed fetuses, and it's a real mess. I just hope the United States will never use depleted uranium again.
Hmm. Let me ask another question. That is, Vice President Cheney gave a speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Nashville on Monday and presented the Bush administration's most forceful arguments yet for attacking Iraq, saying that Saddam Hussein could get nuclear weapons, though presented no evidence of that. Lieutenant Colonel David LePen, what evidence does the military have for Saddam Hussein having nuclear weapons?
Well, as the Vice President and the President have both said, when the time comes to make our case to our allies and to the American people, we'll do that. So we're not at the point where the President has made a decision about any possible military action against Iraq. Regime change in Iraq is the U.S. government's policy and has been since 1998. So that continues to be our policy, but how to achieve that policy is something that is still being discussed. But at the time that the president makes a decision, if he does, then whatever evidence that we have to make our case will surely be presented.
Ramsey Clark.
Punishment and then the trial. You know, you're supposed to act legally. We have a constitution and we have international law that binds us, and you can't attack a country, an act of aggression, because you believe that you have some evidence. I mean, we've been through the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, we've been through Remember the Maine. How many times have we been told these things? The probability that Iraq could be any threat is absurd. Who's got the nuclear weapons? We have them. Who has the nuclear weapons in the region? Israel has them. Who'd they get them from? They got them from the United States, didn't they? They got the technology, they got the materiel. Let's be realistic. If you want to do something about nuclear weapons, you better ban them every place instead of trying to blast nations off the face of the earth because you don't really like them, because you want their oil, because you want to dominate the region, and claim you're afraid they're going to develop a nuclear weapon. The threat is zero. We destroyed, we said, 80%. Your military services said they destroyed 80% of all the military capacity of Iraq, including its any capacity it had for weapons of mass destruction, and then the UN came in and said they destroyed 90% of the remaining. That means they had 2% today what they had in 1991. And how many casualties did we have in 1991? They had 1,000 for each casualty we had. If we bombed the country and civilian population, we destroyed the infrastructure. There were tens of thousands of civilians killed at that time, just as there have been hundreds at least, and probably thousands killed during the 10 years in the past when you've been flying over here every day and shooting at people.
Amy, if I would,
yes,
or if I could, I'd like to point out that it's interesting that Mr. Clark focused on nuclear weapons and didn't mention at all chemical or biological weapons. There was certainly evidence that Iraq used chemical weapons on its own people. They have used chemical weapons on the Iranians, and when UN weapons inspectors
were involved, how many hundreds were involved? How long ago was that? How many did they use in the night? How many did they use in 1991 when we were blasting them off the face of the earth? We bombed them from Basra to Mosul.
Lieutenant Colonel David LePen, I wanted to follow up on that question of the use of biological and chemical weapons. My colleague Jeremy Scahill did a piece called The Saddam and Rumsfeld's Closet about how when Donald Rumsfeld was the envoy for the Reagan-Bush administration to Iraq, he met with Saddam Hussein in 1983 and then again in 1984. He met with him when both the UN and the U.S. State Department had released reports that Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons. Yet at that time, he raised no objection. In fact, he was there recommending the normalization of relations with Saddam Hussein. Your response to that?
Well, one of my colleagues had dealt with this issue, so I'm not fully up to speed on it, but my understanding that Secretary Rumsfeld was in Syria at the time. He was not, there was no evidence that he met with the Iraqis.
No, he went to Iraq, and it was widely reported. Both times. He met with Saddam Hussein, and afterwards, the Reagan and Bush administration normalized relations with Iraq and allowed the sale of, allowed the sale of goods to Iraq.
Again, I'm just not well versed in that aspect of things.
Well, at the time, and this is not, this was in a number of newspapers, the U.S. was very clear, and you certainly know about the Washington Post piece that recently came out that talked about the U.S. knowledge, Defense Intelligence Agency, et cetera, information about the use of biological weapons by Saddam Hussein, and yet they continued to work with, the U.S. continued to work with Saddam Hussein as a one DIA analyst said, what is the difference between people being killed by phosgene or bullets?
Well, I would argue that there's a great difference.
Right, but this was the U.S. government, a U.S. government representative saying this. So the U.S. administration over the years has had clear evidence of Saddam Hussein using biological and chemical weapons, and in the past, the very officials who are speaking about that today were cementing relations with Saddam Hussein, even having that information.
Again, I can't address those issues. They're not something that I deal with.
Well, let me ask you one other question about the no-fly zones that
sure.
you raised. Both former Assistant Secretary Generals of the United Nations, Hans von Sponeck and Dennis Halliday, who both ran the Oil for Food program in Iraq, have said that the United Nations, that there's no basis in the United Nations for the no-fly zones. It's a bilateral agreement between the United States and Britain. France pulled out of this. And that under international law, Iraq has the right to shoot when U.S. and British warplanes fly over its airspace. So what justification is there for these no-fly zones?
Again, I take you back to UN Security Council resolutions at the time of the Gulf War, in particular UN Security Council Resolution number 678, which called upon all member states of the United Nations to use all necessary means to implement the Council's resolutions and to restore international peace and security in the area. Security Council Resolution 687, which provided the conditions for the Desert Storm ceasefire, and again to which the Iraqis agreed, continued to enforce the authorization to use all necessary means for the implementation of Security Council resolutions. There is also a UN Security Council Resolution 688, which demanded that Iraq cease repression of its civilian population. And again, the purpose of the no-fly zones is to prevent Iraq from threatening civilian populations in the north and in the south, as they did early in the 1990s, and also to threaten their neighbors, as they did when they invaded Kuwait. So the legality of the no-fly zones are based in U.N. Security Council resolutions.
But where does it say in any of these U.N. resolutions that the U.S. can fly over sovereign airspace?
Again, it allows all member states to use whatever means are necessary to implement the U.N. Security Council resolutions. And as the U.N. Security Council continues to point out today, Iraq has not complied with those resolutions.
Then why isn't it a UN-imposed no-fly zone?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the UN.
It is the perception of our correspondent, Jeremy Scahill, who spent a good amount of time in Iraq, that the purpose of these U.S. missiles, that the bombing of Iraq by U.S. warplanes, is to terrorize the population. It's certainly the effect of it, not Saddam Hussein. It's
That's
the people who bear the brunt of it.
False. I don't know where he gets his information, but as I said...
Well, of 10 years of bombing of the population.
Well, not 10 years of bombing of the population, and I would point out that the no-fly zones, both of them have not been in place for 10 years, but the no-fly zone attacks that occur are in response to Iraqi firing at our aircraft, and again, our responses are directed at military targets. There is no effort at all, there is no inclination to do anything to the Iraqi people. In fact, that's the reason that our U.S. government policy is regime change in Iraq, is to free the Iraqi people from the repression under which they live. And again, Mr. Clark pointed out cases of leukemia and things of that nature, but refused or chose not to talk about the millions of Iraqis who have died as a result of Saddam Hussein's actions. While he and his coterie live in presidential palaces.
A million Iraqis have died from Saddam Hussein's actions. That's the most absurd comment I've ever heard from among many absurd comments from an official United States government.
Well, sir, the Oil for Food program is well known to bring millions and millions of dollars
into
Iraq.
The Oil for Food program for years, and then we frustrated its implementation for years.
To feed
not enough to do it. There are children dying here. They were well fed before our sanctions. The United States imposed those sanctions on the Security Council, which implemented them, and it's a genocidal act. And there's going to be accountability if we don't stop these aggressions against people. You're talking about 10 years later, because you say they were attacking their own citizens in the South. You still maintain it, or you create a no-fly zone. Still maintain it's like our Indian policy, you know. 250 years later, we're still repressing the Indians because of it's our original policy. Someday, you're going to have to learn to live with the rest of the world, and you can't do it by force, and you can't be shooting at countries every day or every other day because you want to terrorize them or because you want to debilitate them or whatever your purpose is. It's a crime to do that, and you have to stop it.
And Amy, just to finish my point, I'd like to say that again, if your correspondent or Mr. Clark has visited Baghdad and other places in Iraq where they've seen presidential palaces with gold and marble and imported materials that cost millions and millions of dollars that are altars for Saddam Hussein, yet at the same time they complain that people are starving in their country. How could that money be better used?
You've got to be childlike to think palaces cost as much as food. All the value of all the palaces in Iraq wouldn't feed this nation for 3 months, and you must know it. You know,
absolutely
there are a lot of people
not
living here. It takes a lot of food, a lot of medicine, and they don't have it. You ought to come over here and go through the hospitals as we've been doing today and yesterday and the day before, see how much medicine they got, see whether they have enough chemotherapy. They do not to treat people.
Mr.
We watched a young lad today, a beautiful young
why?
Child. They could give him half a dose when he needed a whole dose, and they can't give him radiology, which he really needs because they don't have the capacity.
And Mr. Clark, can you justify us for the people why Saddam Hussein and his regime have the need for multi-million-dollar palaces spread across the country? If their country is starving and people are dying, what need is there for
the
palaces?
Why can't you face the real issue? You haven't talked about his yachts in the Euphrates either. Do you really think that anybody in their right mind would get on a yacht in the Euphrates? The Air Force would blast them off the water if the Marines didn't get there first. And I'm a Marine, I can tell you we'd try to. But you won't face the issue. We are laying our fist on the whole face of this country and every person living in it. And it has nothing, and we're trying to demonize one man to say it's justified for that reason. We're going to liberate him. They haven't asked to be liberated, but the way you do it, if you believe in democracy, is not by guns. You talk about Mao, what we're doing is, you talk about the Germans. Shoot first, ask questions later, and I'll protect you. We know who said that. It was the Gestapo instruction, and that's what you're doing right now. Shoot first, and you'll ask questions later, and somebody will protect you, you hope. That's why we oppose the International Criminal Court, because we're instructing people to do things that are crimes under international law and under U.S. law, for that matter. I've been working that for half a century, and that's my opinion.
Let me ask a final question of Lieutenant Colonel David LePen, and that is this word regime change. It's a new one in the Pentagon lexicon when it comes to Saddam Hussein. Can you talk about why you chose those two phrases?
Well, it's not really a new word. If you go back to the Iraq Liberation Act, which was passed by the U.S. Congress in 1998, signed into law by President Bill Clinton, it says specifically that the policy of the United States towards Iraq was regime change. So it has been around through two administrations now, and through different versions of the U.S. Congress. So again, 1998 is when regime change was formalized in law as the policy of the United States government.
Is the term regime change being used because it is... Let me just ask this.
If you look back through history, you'll find that there is one type of nation that's engaged in regime change without exception, and that's aggressor nations. It's aggressor nations that are in the business of changing regimes. Democratic nations don't do it by violence.
Lieutenant Colonel David LePen, is the reason regime change is being used is because it's illegal to overthrow a sovereign nation?
No, I wouldn't say so. Again, regime change speaks to the desire of the United States to see Iraq become a free and liberated country at peace with its neighbors. Again, the regime change is specifically to not make this about one person. It's not Saddam Hussein necessarily, because his sons are just as evil as he is. We don't wish to see Iraq replace one dictator with another. It's the desire of the United States to see Iraq, the people of Iraq, be able to have a representative government. And there are a number of Iraqi opposition groups today striving for that goal.
So we can hear something meaningful.
Ramsey
Clark. If you
look
at the neighbors, you don't find a single neighbor who is asking for Iraq to be targeted, do you? Turkey doesn't want it. Iran doesn't want it. Saudi Arabia doesn't want it. Jordan doesn't want it. Who are you talking about protecting from the neighbors? Let the neighbors tell you they want you to come in here and bomb. They haven't said it, and the Iraqi people haven't said it, and we are in violation of international law when we attack this country, just as we did Saturday or Sunday, and we've been doing too many days for too many years.
What Arab country, what neighboring country is supporting the United States in this attempted, quote, regime change or overthrow of the government of Saddam Hussein?
Well, again, until, you know, there's been a lot of supposition in the media about attacking Iraq. Until the president has made a decision, it's just that, supposition.
But you certainly...
At the time decision is made, then those countries will either support or they will not. But it's premature to talk about support for military action before any decisions have been made.
Is there any government that is supporting the Bush administration's call for, quote, regime change?
Certainly. There are a number of countries in that region who feel that Saddam Hussein is a threat to the entire region and to their countries.
And which country is supporting the U.S. efforts to
overthrow
Saddam
Hussein?
Well,
we prefer to let the other countries speak for themselves, but it would not be difficult for someone to look at Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and other neighboring countries, Iran, with which Iraq fought a long war, as feeling that Iraq is a peaceful neighbor.
Are you suggesting that Iran, Saudi Arabia, or Kuwait is calling for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein?
Again, I can't speak for other governments. I would just say that especially Kuwait, having been invaded by their Arab brothers in 1991, would most likely still consider that regime to be a threat to their sovereignty. Iraq continues to make bellicose statements about Kuwait. They have not learned their lesson from the Gulf War. They have not lived up to the Security Council resolutions. They have not lived up to the agreements they have made. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of Kuwaitis who are still unaccounted for from the Iraq invasion of Kuwait. And Iraq has not helped Kuwait to determine the fate of those individuals.
And yet it's interesting that Kuwait has not supported the U.S. in the call for regime change.
Well, I don't...
and there are 50 at least Iraqis missing in action and missing from U.S. aggression, to the ones that are claimed to be missing, each person claimed to be missing from any other country, including Kuwait.
But again, Amy, you need to separate.
There's no justification for this policy.
You need to separate the idea of regime change from an attack. A lot of the speculation and discussion has been focused on an attack on Iraq. Again, whether neighboring countries support that or not remains to be seen until a decision is made. But I would argue that there are neighboring countries in that region who feel that Iraq remains a threat to their region, to their countries, and to their peoples. But talking about
attack by the United States
is different than
we have to wrap up this discussion to move on to the immigrant workers at the Los Angeles airport that have been arrested over the last few days. But Ramsey Clark, last word from Basra, Iraq.
Amy, one of the most critically important imperatives for the American people is to prevent their government from engaging in yet another murderous assault on the people of Iraq. After all the misery we've imposed on those people, it's imperative that we stop that. There's a movement that's growing daily. It's fed by support internationally. There'll be big rallies in September 14 through 16, and a big rally in Washington, D.C., and San Francisco on October 26. There'll be weekly meetings all over the country trying to build a movement, as was built in the Vietnam War, to stop us from an even more serious aggression, where we have a chosen enemy that we call evil, like we're God, and have destroyed mercilessly for years, and has been defenseless throughout. We claim to have had 157 casualties when we killed tens and tens of thousands in 42 days in the bombing in 1991. And we're carrying on. We're going to try that again if the people don't stand up and stop it. It's our government. Their acts are our responsibility. And we have to bring this to an end and seek friendship with people and not kill them.
Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General, speaking to us from Basra, Iraq, and Lieutenant Colonel David LePen speaking to us from the Pentagon. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
While patrols guard the borderlines, I'm standing on an unemployment line, and somewhere in the Philippines, a mind that grows dumb from stitching seams. Guatemalan hills of cash, a coffee picker skull is smashed, and they tell me he's my enemy.
Colleen Kotow, Borderlines, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Reuters is reporting that over 100 immigrant airport workers have been arrested in government raids in the Los Angeles area. Government officials report the workers had used false IDs and lied about their immigration status to obtain security clearance. Under legislation passed after September 11th, all immigrants are barred from airport security or screening positions, but most of the arrested immigrants worked in restaurants or other food service areas. Nationwide, some 350 immigrant airport workers have been arrested in similar sweeps. The arrests are part of Operation Tarmac, an initiative of the INS and Social Security Administration to review the immigration records of 200,000 workers at about 100 airports. Triana Siltan is with the Service Employees International Union 1877. She's Building Services Director, joins us from Los Angeles. And George Cardona is Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in Central District of California. George Cardona, can you explain why the airport workers were arrested?
There was a review conducted of everybody at five Los Angeles area airports who held security badges that provided them with access to secure areas where they had access to the tarmac or airplanes. And after that review, charges were filed against those individuals who held those badges, who had used false Social Security numbers to obtain those badges.
Triana Sultan, you're a union organizer. What is your response?
Yeah, actually, a number of the people that were arrested didn't even work at the airport anymore, and a number of the other individuals that were arrested didn't have access to the tarmac. And I think, really, when you look at the situation, if this was done in the name of fighting terrorism and in the name of providing secure airports, it really didn't accomplish that objective. What it did do was divide families and divide communities. The sweep was conducted the day before President Bush came to the Southern California area, and it was clearly to kind of give him a PR firm of saying, look, we're coming in here and we're sweeping up terrorism. A number of the individuals that were arrested, one woman no longer worked at the airport, had to deliver her baby in jail over the course of the weekend, and this really just isn't the way that we're going to be able to create more secure airports. What this does instead is, as I said before, divide up families where you had folks doing raids, going into people's home in the middle of the night and carting them away on federal criminal charges.
George Cardona.
I'll respond to a couple of things. First, fact that President Bush visited the day after was not planned. The date for this had been set well in advance, and it was not. That was basically a coincidence. Second thing is the vast majority of the arrests did not occur in people's homes. They were made at the two airports as people arrived at work. There were some people who did not arrive in response to a request, and so there were some arrests made at their homes, but the vast majority were made at the airports. This wasn't something that was targeted at immigrants. The vast majority of people who were arrested were immigrants. There were, however, others who were arrested who were not. The determinative factor was that these were all people who had used false identifications, false Social Security numbers, to obtain security clearances, and all of them did have security badges that provided them with the ability to access the tarmac and the airplanes.
That's
how they were selected.
I mean, according to the Orange County Register and according to other news sources, also none of the people that were arrested had any known ties to terrorist organizations, and only one individual, to the best of my recollection, had any type of criminal charges pending against them. And so essentially what you had is you have individuals who had originally applied at the airport, a number of individuals originally applied at the airport using false documents, had then gone through the immigration process, had been legalized and welcomed into the United States with open arms, only a couple years later to be picked up in their homes in front of their families, because a number of people were arrested in their homes, and, you know, brought into federal court, even though they currently have legal status to be in this country. And this is just not the way to provide more safe and secure airports, if that's the stated objective. The other thing that this whole situation points to in terms of what happened with Operation Tarmac is that there's a tremendous need in this country to reform our immigration laws. The reason that you have service workers in this country who are undocumented is because we have created a system where our immigration laws no longer keep up with our reality. There needs to be a legalization for the immigrants that provide their work, their services, whether it's janitorial or food services or caring for the sick and elderly, because the reality is our economy is dependent on that immigrant workforce. So those hardworking immigrants that contribute to the economy should have an opportunity to obtain legal status so that we can continue to have a productive economy. And these types of operations point to the fundamental problems in our immigration law.
Triana Sultan and George Cardona, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Triana Sultan of SEIU Union 1877, George Cardona, Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in Central District of California. We will continue, certainly, to follow this issue. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams. As well, we had help from Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Los hombres barbados vinieron por barco y todos dijeron, mi Dios ha llegado.